Bolton calls the Constitution the underdogs. Good afternoon, good evening. I hope you've all had a good day, and welcome to this chat session. I was thinking that the first thing I would do would be to tell you how to get on the chat, but obviously if you're watching me, you already know, so I won't go there. Kind of miss being together and looking forward to this Saturday when we'll have a chance physically to get together and break bread together and talk about our common experiences and see what we're happening, what we're doing and where we're going and all of that. I'm here this evening with Keith Lilly. Keith, welcome.
Thank you, Bill. How are you today?
We're doing fine. And we have Bob Kincaid at the controls here. And before we get into anything substantive, I want to encourage any of you out there that have a question or a comment that you would like entered into tonight's program to email it, if you would, to bobkincaid@gmail.com. That's Bob Kincaid, one word, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail, letter G, M-A-I-L.com. And if you email the question, Bob will make sure that we get it, we'll get it on, we'll address the issues that you want addressed, and hopefully we'll answer your questions. But I want to begin tonight's time together by talking a little bit about what we'll be doing and what you can expect on Saturday. And then I want to talk a little bit about the syllabus that we have, that we've entered on Blackboard, and I have a printed copy of it here. As you already know, I printed this baby, and it's 19 pages long, and I apologize for that. But if you remember last summer, I said it takes me 20 minutes to say hello. So I apologize for it. I want to spend a little bit of time explaining it. And then we want to get into some of the content of the material and some of the books and various other things. So let's begin by talking about what we might do this coming Saturday, Keith. And you chime in. By all means, feel free to do that. We are scheduled to begin at 9 a.m. here at the Irma Bird Center. That's what we're broadcasting from this evening. We're at the Irma Bird Center, and I thought that what I might do, for those of you who have never been here before, is to give you some idea as to where to go when you come here. If you are familiar with the split in the interstates between 77 and 64, if you come down the interstate from Charleston south through Beckley, or you're coming up from Mercer County, from Athens, from Concord, north on 77, you will come to the split. I'm thinking of Johnny Carson here. I'm dating myself. The split in the road, the fork in the road, and all that.
You are correct, sir.
Yeah. If you remember that 64 towards Lewisburg splits off from 77. And depending on which way on the interstate you're coming, if you're coming from that way at all, or if you're coming east on 64, you want to look for Airport Road, which is exit 125B. And so if you're coming from the north, from the Charleston area, just wait till you get to the split and take the 64 split, and 125B will be your third exit. The first exit will be East Beckley. Then you'll come to 125A, which will take you to Beaver, and 125B, which will take you the other way to the airport. When you get off the I-64 at Airport Road, if you're coming from 77, you will get off the interstate at 125B, and it will drop you down under the interstate. And when you do that, you take your very first left, get far over to the left. The very first left is University Drive. And you take that left, and you drive about a mile down on University Drive. The Irma Bird Center is the only building on that road. So, as everybody says, you can't miss it because it's the only building on the road. Seriously. It overlooks the interstate. If you're coming down 64, you can see it. Now, if you're coming from Lewisburg, from the east heading west towards Beckley on 64, just get off at Airport Road, and when you come down the exit, you'll be at Airport Road. Go directly across Airport Road, and that's University Drive. Right. Yeah. And then you'll come to the Bird Center that way. You should not have any trouble by all means, if you do have trouble, call us. My cell phone number is 660-7096. If you get lost or you're going to be late or if there's any problem, by all means, feel free to call us. We'd be more than happy to help you. We're scheduled to begin at 9. We'll be as flexible as we can. I want to share with you that I spoke on the phone this afternoon with Phil Roden. Phil will be here, if you remember. Phil was the DBQ guy from Illinois, and he will be here with us at 9 a.m. on Saturday. And he encouraged me to remind you this evening of two things. One is that, if possible, if you have writing samples from your students, good ones, bad ones, it doesn't matter. If you bring them, it makes the program a lot easier and a lot more realistic, because we're dealing with real samples. So if you've given any DBQ writing assignments to your students, bring samples if you can. The other thing that Phil would like you to do is to bring the MiniQ book, the loose leaf booklet, with you. If you remember, this is the book that contains the unit that we did last summer on Valley Forge, Would You Have Quit, if you remember that discussion. And so Phil would like you to bring the MiniQ books. They will be with us again this summer, during the summer program, for our second program on the Civil War and Reconstruction. We'll get to that in a second. So the first thing that I want to tell you about Saturday's program is that we will begin about 9. Margaret, I believe, sent you the agenda. You will notice that the first major piece of the program is devoted to Phil Roden. Phil will be on approximately at 9. He's asked for about 4 hours, which will include lunch. I put working lunch on the agenda, and I talked to Phil today about that, and he says that's great. What we'll do is we'll actually use the lunch hour while we eat lunch to work on projects or assignments that he's going to give us. Phil should be done, I've assured him, by 2 or 2:15, so he'll be making his reservations to fly out, probably out of Charleston, later on Saturday afternoon. At that time, Doris Williams will be with us. And Doris, we've plugged into the agenda about an hour and 15 minutes. She'll need about an hour and 15 minutes, or an hour and a half. And she'll be with us until late in the afternoon, probably 3:30, quarter of 4, something like that, on Saturday afternoon. At that point on your agenda, we have the pretest for the second unit of our program, which will be on the 19th century. And again, don't worry about it. These are questions, if you remember the pretest we took last year on the founding. This is a continuation of that. I'm going to tell you right now that Keith Lilly put this sucker together. So if you have any complaints about the program, about the test, blame him. Seriously, it's a pretest, and obviously what we want to do is use the pretest to measure the effectiveness of what we're going to be doing, both in the summertime and during the online class that will follow that. So we will take time late after Doris finishes on Saturday afternoon to do the pretest.
I will point out, Bill, that by designing that pretest, I did my best to try and have the material deal with the types of content that we will deal with in the summer program.
Right. And what we want to do is make sure that what we deal with in the summer program encompasses the issues that you need to deal with in the standards for teaching 19th century America. And again, we look to you as the teacher, depending on whether you teach at the elementary level, the middle school level, or the high school level, to basically adjust the material according to your needs. In other words, we assume that all the time, in everything you're reading and everything you're writing and everything else in this program, remember the key is that you are classroom teachers. If this program doesn't have a positive effect on what happens with your teaching in your classroom, then ultimately we're all wasting our time, very honestly. So I look to you to be the judge of where the most effective place for you to be is in any of this program. If you notice in the syllabus, I tried to build in as much flexibility as possible. We'll deal with that, because I think many of the things that I would say will be helpful and hopefully reassuring. but I wanted you to have as much flexibility because I want you to be able to go where you will find the most benefit for your teaching and the learning experience of your students. That's really what this is about. Remember, this grant is primarily designed, it is a professional development program designed principally to strengthen your command of the content for this period, for the whole period, the whole series that constitutes United States history. So basically, our goal is to make you aware of where you need to go for the content and make you aware of some of the key questions and some of the biggest areas of conflict and interpretive issues, places that you want to go in your teaching that will excite your students about what they're learning and at the same time remain consistent with your goals, your objectives, as far as the standards are concerned. So we look to you to be a real guide for us here. I'm trying to give you as much information as possible on where to go and where to look for the information you need. But we need to trust your skills as a teacher to best guide you in where is going to be the best place for you to go in terms of your teaching and your students and their needs and their skills and their abilities. Obviously, if you teach elementary grades in United States history, you're going to be going to a different place. On the other hand, many of the skills are the same thing. They're at a different level, obviously, but many of the skills are at the same thing. Many of the skills are the same at the DBQ level and all the rest of it. Ultimately, what we're looking for is areas of conflict. We want students to appreciate the fact that none of this stuff is in concrete, that much of it is interpretive, and we want them to be able to have the skills to learn how to do that interpretation. So basically, that's what we're talking about. So on Saturday, we will begin about 9. Phil Roden will be on until about 2:15 in the afternoon. Then obviously we'll have breaks and we'll have snacks and we will be providing lunch. And then after our break in the afternoon, after Phil Roden finishes, Doris Williams will take over. And when she finishes, sometime after 3:15, 3:30, 3:45, something like that, we will take another break and then we will begin the pretest. And then we'll have dinner. And we'll be providing dinner. We've invited a couple of people to join us for dinner on Saturday evening. Dinner will be approximately 5:30. I mentioned on the syllabus, and I want to mention again, we promise that you will be out of here by 7:30. And then after dinner, we'll address some of the issues we're dealing with, the essays and the course and some of the nuts and bolts stuff. At the same time, we want to give you the opportunity on Saturday to fill out the paperwork. All of you have the final portion of your first year stipend coming. So we'll be paying you each a $200 stipend, which will be the final payment on your first year stipend. And I realize if you add all of this together, it comes to $1,100, not $1,000. But we've lost some folks, and we can do that. So basically, Margaret will be giving you paperwork on Saturday. And when you fill that out, then Risa will be sending you the check for $200, which will be the final stipend on your first year payment. And then, of course, once we begin our summer session in June, at the end of June, the stipend will begin again with our summer program and so on. So that's one of the things that we'll be doing on Saturday. One of the other things that we'll be doing, I am so darn excited about this. One of the things that we'll be doing on Saturday will be giving each of you a Kindle. I'm sure if you're like me, it's everywhere. The whole idea of e-books and the extent to which Amazon is doing so well with people ordering books on Kindles. What we have done, and I thank Risa and Keith Butcher, who's the director at Risa, for this, because this weekend, Keith physically, by himself, along with his daughter, loaded all these Kindles. What we've done is we've taken the books, we'll be dealing with this tonight in our program, about the readings for this particular unit. We have preloaded the Kindles with materials that you'll need for the second unit of this class, the stuff that we'll be talking about this evening, along with the third unit of the class. And the third unit of the class is going to be based, after the Constitution is ratified, on the beginning of the Washington administration. We'll be looking at Washington and John Adams, the disputed election of 1800, the election of Jefferson, and then the move into the War of 1812 and the election of James Madison as president. We'll be looking at that as in the completion of this course, which is the third unit. And on your Kindles for that, we have preloaded Gordon Wood's newest book, which just came out this past year, 2010, called Empire of Freedom.
Yeah. Empire of Liberty.
Empire of Liberty, Empire right. Of Liberty. Empire of Liberty. All I can hear is George Bush saying freedom, freedom. Empire of Liberty. And so that book will be on there. It's a big hummer. It's this big. It's just about the most complete treatment of the early national period from the ratification of the Constitution into the early decades of the 19th century that I've seen. It's one of the best things. I mean, if you're teaching, there's no way that you can get your hands on anything better as a secondary source than this. And of course, the other thing...
Bill, it's not just politics. Wood also deals in that book with also social issues, with religion, with art, architecture, all those kinds of issues, putting it in that context.
Everything that you would need to teach a good unit.
And I believe that's part of the Oxford History of the United States series.
Right. Yeah. It's a superb book. And not only that, but we'll supplement it with places that you can go for primary letters. By that time, we'll have access to Rotunda, which we'll tell you about. You'll be able to directly access the papers of Jefferson and Washington and John Adams and all the rest of it. You'll be able to go to the primary sources as you see fit. We'll also be working with some of the materials related to the adoption of the Federal Bill of Rights once the first Congress meets under the Constitution. And we'll have that. We'll give you some of the primary documents to go to in terms of speeches during the debate in Congress. Madison's fulfillment of his commitment to the people of Virginia is part of his election to the first Congress, to see that Congress fulfills its obligations to make amendments to the Constitution the first order of business of the new government under President Washington. So that will be, you know, that will be the third unit of this class, and that will be the final one for this course. So all of the Kindles will have been preloaded. On the Kindles, we will have, and I want you to, I'm going to hold up the books mainly because I want you to see the size of them, because they're on your syllabus. One of the first ones that we have on the Kindles is Richard Beeman's book called Plain Honest Men, which is on the Constitutional Convention. And this is chapter by chapter, day by day, the events of the Constitutional Convention as written primarily from the notes on the convention of James Madison. The best primary source, other than the letters back and forth between Jefferson and Madison and Jay and Hamilton and Washington and all the rest of them, the best source on what happened in Philadelphia at the Constitutional Convention is to be found in Madison's notes of the convention. It's the best source there is of what happened on a day-to-day basis. As I've pointed out to you on the syllabus, Madison's notes, day by day, are available on the Internet. There's no reason to buy them. There's no reason to load them on your Kindles, because they are available to all of us free on the Internet. If you go to Google and you Google Madison's notes on the Federal Convention, you will not only get access to the notes, but you'll get a calendar. And on that calendar, beginning in May 1787, will be May, June, July, August, and September. And all you do is click on the appropriate day, and you'll get Madison's notes of what happened, who spoke, and what they said on that day of the Federal Convention. And the best way to know what days you want to look at, what speeches you want to look at, those kinds of things, is in Richard Beeman. He gives the best account, because he wrote this book from Madison's notes, along with access to the letters back and forth between Federalists and Anti-Federalists and all the rest of it. So my feeling is that Richard Beeman is going to be your source for where in Madison's notes you want to go for the speeches and the letters that will help you find the primary documents you want in the Constitutional Convention. The Internet is an unbelievable resource. All you need to do, literally, is go to the Internet, Google Madison's notes, And there is a calendar. Just click on the day that you want, and you'll get Madison's notes for that day. I mean, it's unbelievable. What Richard Beeman's book is an absolute must. It's a superb book. I've read it. It's quite, as you can tell by the thickness of it, it's quite heavy. We'll get to that in a minute.
Bill, I'll point out that archive.org, if you really wanted a kind of an e-book type of copy of Madison's notes, I'm sure that you can probably find it there.
Yeah, it's Madison's notes are available. In fact, when you go on Google, you'll find two or three different sources on the Internet where you can get the Madison's notes. The only thing I would tell you is the notes are the same no matter who publishes them. They remain the same. Another book that is on that will be on your Kindles is Pauline Myers' book on ratification. This one is top seller on Amazon, top seller on the History Book Club book list. This book was just published in October 2010. It just came out. This one also is one massive book. This covers the story of ratification as it's not been covered before by accomplished historians. Pauline Myer is one of the best, as many of you know from her books on the Revolution. Pauline Myer is an accomplished historian of the American Revolution and Constitution. And I wanted to tell you this because I think we can all relate to this. If you're like me, it's like when you go on a when you go visit a historical site and you take a moment, and it doesn't matter where you go, you go to Colonial Williamsburg or any of the battle sites of the Civil War or even Richmond up and down Monument Avenue or any of those places. If you take the time to really look at what you're seeing, let me turn that around. If you take the time to see what you're really looking at, if you're like me, you'll begin to appreciate what happened there what happened on this site. And you begin to get kind of a loosey-goosey feeling because it's an emotional feeling. You are standing at the very place where this happened. If you ever want to have this experience, if you ever visit Richmond, Virginia, I lived there for 16 years. If you go to St. John's Church on Mission Hill in Richmond, in East Richmond, on Sunday afternoons during the summertime, they have live performances of Patrick Henry's Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death speech. And they come in uniform, and they have, when you go in, there's no charge. They ask for donations, but there's no charge. And you sit in the church, in St. John's Church, and they reserve certain seats because, in costume, the founders who actually sat there sit in the places where they actually sat in the church when Patrick Henry's speech was made. And so what you find is that if you're sitting there and there's a seat right beside you, and they tell you not to fill that seat, it's because Madison, Jefferson, Washington, somebody, Sam Adams, somebody who was there is going to be sitting beside you. And I'm telling you, if you don't get goosebumps, I brought one of my closest friends from graduate school who majored in math, visited me in Richmond, and I took him to St. John's, and I didn't know. He's a mathematician. What do I know? I don't know anything about math. That's one reason I'm a historian. But anyway, I took Tom Haig to St. John's Church, and we sat there during this performance. He was with my wife and I, and I looked over at him, and the tears were running down his face. I couldn't believe it. I mean, it is absolutely an emotional experience. The point I'm trying to make is that if you can relate, or you can get your students to relate at all emotionally to this material, it's unbelievable the effect that it will have. That's the advantage of primary source materials. That's one of the advantages. Why am I saying this? Because in this book, which you will get on your Kindle, Pauline Myers, in her prologue, in her introduction, credits John Kaminsky, because this book is written from the project that John Kaminsky has spent the last 35 years of his life editing. The 23 volumes of the Ratification Project that John Kaminsky has been editor of is the basis of Pauline Myers' book. What she will tell you in her introduction, in her preface, is that John Kaminsky's project has completed the ratification papers on 8 states, and it still has 5 more to go to cover all 13. They currently have 23 volumes published. It looks like, from what John says, they'll have probably 30, 31 volumes done before they finish. Most of her material is in the 8 states that are completed, and she said that they've done a rather cursory, superficial job on the other states because John's project is not completed. What I'm trying to tell you is this book is written principally from the project that John Kaminsky has been editing for 35 years. So it gives us, because we know John, I know it gives me that feeling because I know John, it gives us a sense that we're kind of connected to this, that this is real history happening and we have a connection. If you go online, you can email John Kaminsky at any time. I've done it. John will answer. John lives at his computer. You won't go more than 24 hours unless he's out of town on a trip, and he goes on a lot of those, I might say. But if you basically email John with questions or whatever, what we're anticipating in these chats as we continue is that we're going to be able to get John Kaminsky on some of these. We'll be able to connect with him in future chats. Bob Kincaid is in the process of getting some equipment where we're going to be able to do split-screen operations here, and we'll have live interviews with John Kaminsky, and we can actually talk to him about his presentation or whatever. And remember, by the way, that if you go to Bob Kincaid's website, which is headonradionetwork.com, and click on Ustream, all the presentations we had this summer, Tom Tierney, David House, John Kaminsky, Jeff Biggers, Karen Varanch, all of it is there. So you have archived on that the presentations that we had this summer. So if you'd like to go back before you write your essays in this, before you do your reading, if you'd like to go back and revisit John Kaminsky's visit when he covered the 1780s and the Confederation and the movement towards the Constitutional Convention and all that, by all means, you can do that. Just go to Bob Kincaid's website, headonradionetwork.com, and then go to Ustream. That's the way you get on this program tonight. And archive there are all the programs that we had from last summer's presentation.
Before you move on, let me kind of clarify one thing about Pauline Meyer's book, which, again, you mentioned it was a History Book Club selection of the month. So this is certainly making waves in the historical community. But with Rotunda, essentially, you have access to the primary source material that she used to write this book.
Right. When we and again, let me tell you that at Concord right now is a server that we bought with the grant. And all the Rotunda material is on it. And what we had to get was a license which gives us the right to make Rotunda available to you off campus. At this point, we are ready to go on campus with access to Rotunda, but you got to be on campus at Concord to get it. What we need is IP addresses so that I can give you the IP address which will allow you and your local library to access Rotunda from your home or from your school or wherever it is. You will have access to all the sources, and in Rotunda is John Kaminsky's entire project. All 23 papers. Volumes of the ratification project will be available to you as part of this program. And it's on that material available to you in Rotunda that Pauline Myers wrote this book, as Keith pointed out. So basically what we've got then is that on the Constitutional Convention, Richard Beeman has covered the convention from Madison's notes. You have Richard Beeman's book, and you have access to Madison's notes on the Internet. Pauline Myers covers ratification in each state, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Virginia, New York. And then she does quite a bit with New Hampshire and the Carolinas and that. But most of the content, most of the detail in this is from the books that John, in the states that John Kaminsky's project has already dealt with. And given where you want to go with this, you'll have access to Rotunda, to all those primary sources. So those are two of the books that we have preloaded on your Kindles that you will receive on Saturday.
And Bill, this is something I always try to tell my students, is the idea that a good secondary source will always lead you to primary sources.
Yeah.
I tell students, if you're going to start a research project or a paper, in fact, I'm teaching a modern European history class here on Wednesdays, and they're doing research papers and projects. You know, the first place to start is a good secondary source. It will always lead you back, and
right.
both of these do that.
And, of course, if you look at the back of both of these books, there are extensive pages of footnotes by page. And the footnotes will tell you the letter collections and which letter you want to go to, and you'll have the you'll have access. It'll say in the footnotes, Madison's notes, August 6th, 1787. And you go to Madison's notes online, August 6th, and there's Madison's notes from which Richard Beeman's book is written. And past tests, that's not what we're about at all. The purpose of this, what I've tried to do in this course, and those said, the reason they are so long, is I'm trying to basically create for you, as best I can, a picture of what people are saying about the founding, where to go, what the best sources are to get your hands on what really happened, because as teachers, your students have a right to access to this material. So we're depending on you. And again, when we get final access to Rotunda, you will have an IP address. Your local library will have an IP address. And what that means is that as part of this program, that the local libraries, you and your students will have direct access to the primary sources that are available on Rotunda and, of course, to the primary sources that already are available on the Internet. A third book that will be preloaded on your Kindles is Gordon Wood's The Radicalism of the American Revolution. If you remember, in the first unit of this course, I asked you to look at the first two parts of this book. The first part is on monarchy. The second part is on republicanism. The third part is entitled Democracy. The book is divided into thirds. It is a Pulitzer Prize. This book won the Pulitzer Prize. I have read it three times because from my experience, it deserves the Pulitzer. This is one of the finest books I've ever read. I mean, I've got to say. And it's not necessarily because I agree with Gordon Wood. In fact, in the syllabus that is on Blackboard that you all received a copy of, I think I made the comment about Jensen when I was a student in Jensen's seminar, graduate seminar. Merrill Jensen, we'll get to him in a second. Merrill Jensen used to make a comment. He didn't mention Gordon Wood by name because at that time Gordon Wood, you know, but Jensen died in 1983. I believe it was 83, 1980 or 1983.
Early 80s, yeah.
So anyway, but he was talking about intellectual historians. The one he was referring to mainly was Bernard Bailyn. And basically what he used to talk about were what he called, what people used to refer to as intellectual historians. People who believe that the only way to really understand and write history was to look at ideas. And intellectual historians believe that if you deal with people's philosophy, deals with people's ideas, the way they look at the world, then you will be able to understand not only what they do, but why they do it. And Jensen used to say all the time, and I think I shared this quote with you in the syllabus, find me a person whose behavior is driven by what he believes. And I challenge you to find me a person. Jensen's belief was that people act out of self-interest, that people do things because it's going to benefit them in some way. And that what you have to do is try to get at the way people are going to benefit or the way other people are not going to benefit in order to understand why people do or don't do things. He was very, very suspicious of what he called intellectual historians, people who he believes spend 90% of their time with their head in the clouds playing with the great ideas of life, you know, that ultimately you had to get down to the real world where people live, how they put bread on the table, how they earn their living, those kinds of things.
So was it fundamentally a difference of opinion in terms of what really is human nature?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And so he had the more cynical,
right,
realist view.
So that's my background. I'm a Jensen guy, and I think I said that in the syllabus as well. And in rereading the Articles of Confederation, the first time I read the Articles of Confederation was in 1965. And I hadn't really read it until now, since then. Unbelievable what this guy knew. I appreciate more now what Jensen knew than I ever did when I knew him. I just, the issue was not him, it was me. I had no idea how profound this guy was in terms of his understanding of this period. He was incredible. But my point is that Gordon Wood is an intellectual historian. This is a book, there's an awful lot of ideas in this book about American culture, about speculation as to why people did things and what people read and how they were influenced by what they read, how they were influenced by the music they listened to, how they were influenced by the politics, the ideas and the speeches of their leaders and those kinds of things. This is an absolutely superb book. You have it on your Kindles. The first two portions of this book, the first part is on monarchism, and basically what Wood does is lay out the structure of traditional society as it was supposed to be organized. In other words, efforts to recreate England in the New World during the colonial period. If we had Bob Bliss, which he was sick, but he'll be here this coming summer, Bob Bliss would have gone deeply into this whole thing about the nature of colonial society and colonial culture and all of it. But in the eyes of many of the colonies as they were founded, the idea was to transport England, English society, as it existed over to the New World, to organize it the same way with the same assumptions and the same class structure and power structure and all of it. Gordon Wood, in the first third of this book, explains how that society, how that structure, how that culture was organized. In the second part of the book, which is entitled Republicanism, he points out that many of the ideas of the period that we associate with republicanism, the ideas that really drove Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence, the idea that government was created primarily based on the consent of the governed, the idea that the power that government gets is from the people, that people must voluntarily consent to be governed in order for government to be legitimate, the idea that the rules, the role of government is specifically defined, as Jefferson says, to the protection of life, liberty, and as Jefferson's phrase, the pursuit of happiness, that ultimately government's power is limited, it is not absolute, and that the ultimate power over government comes from the people, the idea of popular sovereignty, power in the hands, the ultimate source of power in the people. And these ideas of republicanism conflict with the monarchical kind of society that the colonials tried to create in America. And what Wood points out is that there's a basic philosophical conflict between the way people thought society ought to be organized and the way the real-life experience of people living in the colonies caused it to be lived. And he points out the conflicts and the contradictions. And then finally, in the section that he calls democracy, he points out the new synthesis, the new definition of republicanism that begins to define the American experience. And it's that idea of republicanism that carries us into the 19th century. The idea of parties, the idea of free speech, the idea of a loyal opposition, the idea of elected officials' accountability to the electorate, the idea that people must be allowed to vote consistently, the idea that people must be given a voice, that there must be a free press, that there must be a free speech. Most people don't realize that the whole idea of free speech in our society was the idea that in order for people to intelligently and effectively participate in their government, they had to have the freedom to speak and the freedom to have their voice heard. And so ultimately, the whole idea of free speech in the First Amendment was the idea to protect the rights that people had to have in order for Republican government, as it was being defined then, to work. So what Gordon Wood does in this book is lay out the traditional society on paper as it was supposed to exist in colonial America, point out the conflicts that created real conflict between the ideas of republicanism and the ideas of the traditional society, and then deal with the synthesis, what ultimately comes out of this, which is the republicanism that takes us into the 19th century. It's one of the finest pieces of historical writing I've ever seen. It's fabulous.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe we even talked about this a little bit last time in the last chat we did, but Wood essentially also points out that these ideas are drawn actually from
you know, 17th century England.
Right.
Resistance to the Stuarts, the English Civil War,
right.
The Protectorate, the Glorious Revolution, the Bill of Rights, etc. But he does see a distinct difference in terms of the concept of sovereignty. I mean, you're talking about free speech. In Parliament, in England, you had a right to say anything that you wanted to say
right.
within Parliament, but not when you walked outside, outside of the building.
And if you were not in Parliament, you didn't have the right
to
free speech.
You didn't say it. You didn't say it.
You better not say it, exactly.
You can't say it about the king and the king's ministers
right.
if you're outside of the building. And so, in essence, Parliament was sovereign in England.
Yeah.
And that's... The people, in essence, are represented by Parliament.
That's the English Bill of Rights,
right.
which creates the supremacy of Parliament, that the result of the Glorious Revolution. And if you ever get the chance, turn on public TV on Sunday evenings.
Yeah,
and
the Prime Minister's
watch the
questions.
Debates. Watch the Prime Minister's questions, which is live coverage of the British Parliament, and notice how free speech in a Republican system really works. I mean, it's not nothing like a presidential press conference in this country. You know, so much was made of the person yelling out liar to President.
Right.
To President.
Be nothing in the English system.
Obama.
Yeah.
That's done all the time.
Yeah. The right honorable gentleman is a liar.
The right. Yeah. Exactly. The right honorable. You know, is a liar, is a bum, is a thief, is a, you know, whatever. It's unbelievable. But you begin to get the idea that this is the way Republican government was conceptually designed. To maximize the freedom of speech and the conflict of ideas and all the rest of it. Gordon Wood does such a fabulous... I wrote in my book, we talked, you know, before this summer about marking up your book, but at the end of Unit 2 in this book, I made a note to myself. And basically what I was saying was that every political scientist, everybody who teaches or fashions themselves to teach American government ought to read this book. Because this book deals with the structure of society in terms of what people believed, why it is that we constantly defer to our betters, why it is, I mean, we talked today about unemployment in America today. And what he deals with is where did the idea come from that if you couldn't find a job, it's your fault. You know, one of the things that's amazing about American society, people used to do this back, looking back at the Great Depression in the 1930s, where 25% of the people were unemployed. And people would say, God, 25% of the population couldn't find jobs, and they didn't revolt. I mean, there wasn't a revolution. There wasn't a Marxist revolution in America in the 1930s. Why? And somehow... Our culture breeds the idea that in a society where people are free to be what they want to be, that if you can't find a job, it's your fault, not somebody else's. Now, we know, given the recent unemployment situation, with the mess on Wall Street and the mortgage market and the extent to which the Madoffs and all the rest of it made off with our retirement money and all everything that we talk about, we know that people who lost their jobs... lost them through no fault of their own. And we know that it's taken a long time for the economy to come back. And only very, very slowly are jobs coming back. Not nearly fast enough. And it bothers people. But the fact of the matter is, people still believe in this society that if you can't find a job, it's something that's lacking in you. I can't tell you the number of people, the number of students, former students, that I talk to at Concord that'll come back and say, going to college for me was a waste of time because I got a degree and I can't find a job. And I have to tell them, people don't hire degrees, they hire people.
Mm.
You have to have a degree to qualify for the job, but you're the one that they hire, not your degree. And people need to know that and appreciate it. Anyway,
well, if you think about the 19th century Horatio Alger myth,
yeah, the
it
stories
really fits
about,
in
yeah.
there. You know, that by pluck and luck,
if you apply
yourself properly,
yeah, if I pick the right numbers because of Powerball, I'm going to be rich. You know, Gordon Wood's book is fantastic. You will have a copy of it on your Kindles. And finally, on your syllabus, I put John Kaminsky's book on Federalists and Anti-Federalists on your syllabus. It turns out that I could not get that book for the Kindles. It's not available in ebook form. I emailed John Kaminsky, and he said that he would contact the publisher and find out what's necessary to make his book available on Kindle. But at this point, I was not able to get John Kaminsky's book. It's not very big on Federalists and Anti-Federalists, because he has a collection of the best, the most appropriate Federalist papers, and contrary to that, the Anti-Federalist papers that deal, and he has, as I told you in your syllabus, he breaks his book down into five or six topics, and he has things like representation, the power of the president, the Senate, the courts, etc. And he puts together the best of the Federalist arguments and the best of the Anti-Federalist argument around each of those themes. I was unable to get John Kaminsky's book on Kindle. And to be very honest with you, I couldn't afford it. His book sells for a paperback for almost $30, about 28 something, 28.35 or 28.45 or something like that. Anyway, if I bought that book for everybody in hard book form, it would have cost us $1,000. And I couldn't justify that, especially with John's trying to find out what he needs to do to get it available on Kindle. So what I did is I found an alternative to that, which is the Federalist Anti-Federalist papers put together by Ketchum, which are the same primary sources, the Patrick Henry speeches and letters, Samuel Bryant in Pennsylvania. It's much of the same material. And on Kindles, it costs each edition on Kindle costs 99 cents.
Excellent.
So I can get 75 copies of that book on the Anti-Federalist literature for $75. 75 copies for $75. So I put that on your Kindles. And if John's book comes out later in e-books, we'll be able to get it. These will be your Kindles. We've put on them the stuff that you'll need for this course. And so what you have on your Kindles will be Beeman's book, Pauline Meyer's book. You will have Ketchum's collection of Anti-Federalist papers. And you will have Gordon Wood's book on the radicalism of the American Revolution. Absolutely fantastic sources. And Kindle, the most expensive one was Pauline Meyer's book, and it was $14.79 on Kindle. And the rest of them were $9.99, and the Ketchum collection of Anti-Federalist papers was 99 cents. So you can't beat that.
I can't find a price here, but I would assume this book is probably $30.
And I think you can get it, like, if you belong to the History Book Club, you can get it for like $24.99, something
right.
like that. $14.79 on Kindle. So the result is we're able to provide you with all of these sources on Kindle. We'll give them to you on Saturday. Margaret just brought them all back today from RISA. And I got to tell you, I mentioned at the beginning that Keith Butcher, the director at RISA, over the weekend loaded these Kindles himself. And when Margaret tried to apologize for the fact that he had to do all that work, he said that his daughter spent the weekend helping him, and it was quality time that he spent with his daughter. So I thought, God, that's kind of neat. So anyway, we have our Kindles, and we will be giving them to you on Saturday. So again, to kind of complete Saturday's program, we will have Phil Roden with us. We'll have Doris Williams. We'll do the pretest. We will have what I think are going to be good meals. We will be giving you, Margaret will be giving you the paperwork that you need to be paid your final portion of your stipend, which will be $200 each, and you'll be getting Kindles loaded with all of these books. So basically, that's the program that we've got on Saturday, and I committed to you in the syllabus and in the agenda, and I'll say it again, we will be out of here by 7:30, so nobody's going to be home so late that it's embarrassing. But we have quite a bit that we want to do that day, and we want to make sure that it's a valuable day. Keith suggested before we went on, and I'll let you elaborate on this a little bit, that we really need to spend a little bit of time tonight sharing with you what this summer is going to look like. So,
well, in terms of the Civil War section, we have a lot of, I think, good things planned. We're going to have Willis Nordland from the New River Community and Technical College. He's an economist, but he's certainly an expert in so many different eras of American history. And he's, I believe, going to do a presentation probably on the Jacksonian era. and especially the bank war and those types of issues, especially like metalism as opposed to paper money and things of that nature. One thing I'm really excited about is we have Dave Bard, who many of you had at Concord in years past, who's going to come back, and he's going to do a field trip with us. Yeah, and we're going to go to Lewisburg.
On Friday, July 8th.
July 8th. We're going to go to Lewisburg, and we will look at the Battle of Lewisburg in 1862 at that particular juncture. And we'll also probably look at a few sites there in Lewisburg. You have the Old Stone Presbyterian Church, and you have, of course, the Confederate Cemetery and several things that may be of interest to us. And then we're going to go to Droop Mountain in Pocahontas County and step back into 1863 and investigate the key decisive battle in terms of the Civil War in this region, one that goes a long way to determining what would be in West Virginia and what's going to stay in West Virginia and what's not going to be in West Virginia. And that is something that I'm looking forward to incredibly. And this goes along with Dave Bard's book on the New River Valley Campaign. And so essentially we're going to be doing a couple driving tours with him. And he's agreed to do that with us, and he's going to develop packets of maps and things of that nature to kind of help us so we know what we're looking at.
So we can see what's really there.
Especially those of us who are not well-versed in military history, right?
I don't know anybody in this room that's said that.
So we'll be doing a little bit of military history with the Civil War section. I think we have a few more people lined up.
Right.
We
don't have the program for the summer put
not
together
yet.
But let me tell you what we've got. Keith and I are so excited. Besides Dave Bard, who's agreed to give us the Friday, July 8th, the whole day, as much of it we need. So we'll get buses. We will feed everybody. And we will all go on the bus, and we'll have Dave Bard with us as our tour guide. And he'll tell us what we're looking at and all the rest of it. So besides the field trip and besides Willis Nordland, let me tell you a little bit about Willis Nordland. Willis has a PhD in economics, and his dissertation was the origins of and the story behind the minimum wage, the creation during the Roosevelt New Deal administration of the legislation that created the minimum wage. Willis Nordland is still considered to be the person in looking at the minimum wage in the country. And he's here. He's on the faculty teaching economics at New River Community College. He's a good friend of both Keith's and mine. And he has agreed to be with us. And he's going to do the economic piece at the beginning of the 19th century coming out of this class. He's going to deal with the emergence of sectionalism in the country as the North developed one way and the Southern plantation system developed another way. And he is fantastic. Okay, besides those two folks, Dr. Rao, Steve Rao, who's the director of Concord's library, has agreed to do the following. In Concord's library, we have hard copies of every Harper's magazine published in the 19th century. And Dr. Rao, on one morning or afternoon program, we haven't put it together yet, is going to wheel those hard copies, and we're going to look at the Civil War as it appeared, as it unfolded in Harper's Magazine from 1856 to 1866. We're going to look at that 10-year period of the Civil War, and we're going to go through Harper's magazines to do it. This is a thing that he does. He did it at LSU. When he was down in Baton Rouge, and we're going to do it this summer. He's going to do it with us. In addition, we have Stanley Cutler, and I don't know what to say about Stanley Cutler. Stanley is a retired historian. He's a constitutional historian. He has taught not only constitutional history, but he taught constitutional law at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Stanley Cutler is the person who filed the lawsuit that ultimately caused the Supreme Court to open up the Watergate papers and all the Nixon tapes and everything, the release of the Nixon tapes that was associated with Watergate came as a result of the lawsuit filed by Stanley Cutler. Stanley continues to write editorials for the New York Times and the Chicago Tribune and the Boston Globe and all of these, the Washington Post and all of these major publications. And Stanley is going to deal in this coming year, this coming summer with us, is going to deal with the constitutional questions surrounding the Marshall Court and the whole issue of the Marshall and the Taney Court related to the idea of human rights as played out in the case of Dred Scott. And then he's going to basically deal with us the Supreme Court's role in the whole issue of Reconstruction after the Civil War.
Which thus will also get him into impeachment.
Yeah.
Because we deal with the Johnson impeachment,
Johnson impeachment.
Reconstruction.
And Stanley's going to do all of that. We have, and he's been with this fellow's been with us before, Carson Holloway, who is a political scientist, currently teaching at the University of Nebraska in Omaha. And Carson is going to come and do, I mean, he was so excited when I called him. I couldn't believe it.
He's a former Concord
faculty. He used to teach at Concord in the 90s. And Carson used to do a course at Concord on Abraham Lincoln, on the political and philosophical ideas of Abraham Lincoln. And he's going to basically do a presentation on Lincoln and Lincoln's whole approach to the issue of human rights and the issue of slavery and emancipation and all the rest of it, which is very consistent with our theme of the values and the principles and the ideals of the founders. And he's going to look at that through the eyes of Abraham Lincoln. He's going to do that. So, and then we've got a pretty darn good Civil War historian right here in Keith Lilly, and he's going to do some stuff with us as well.
Yeah, I plan on basically, one thing I certainly want to get to is with the PRISM element, thinking about West Virginia statehood in context of the Civil War.
Right, the creation of West Virginia.
Because it is a constitutional issue with Article 4, Section 3. And also the Reconstruction, in essence, looking at Reconstruction in West Virginia and how, in a sense, that is somewhat of a microcosm of the macrocosm of what goes on generally in the nation generally. So I will try to focus to some degree on state history.
One of the things that we want to include, but I don't know that this second year is the place to do it. I want to do quite a bit with labor history.
Right.
And the emergence of the organization of organized labor in America, the right to collective bargaining, the whole role that organized labor is projected to play and indeed does play in American society. And in year three of our program, which is going to be based on the issue of civil rights and civil liberties, we're going to be looking at the rights and the liberties and the role played by organized labor, by women, civil rights movement in American society, all of it. And for that, we're going to bring back Stanley Cutler big time. Because Stanley's the guy.
And I will point out, and I believe you probably know this, but Willis Nordland is currently writing a book on strikes.
On labor strikes
in American history, yeah.
So, I mean, we've got an absolutely fantastic program. So and let me go ahead.
One more thing.
That's all right.
Thing
that
I certainly want to get to is, and I think I've done this in presentations for grants in the past, but I want to think some about the founding of the Confederacy and essentially how the Confederate framers saw the Constitution, how Jefferson Davis and Alexander Stevens see the Constitution that they have for the Confederacy in light of what we've seen in terms of the founding. So that will be a big part of what we'll do in terms of Civil War and Reconstruction.
Right.
Because I'll just let the cat out of the bag, they felt that they were the true meaning.
They were the revisiting of the founders.
Right.
They were the founders. They were the ones that were consistent with the founders,
in essence,
not Lincoln.
Lincoln had broken with the past,
Lincoln had violated the compact with the founders, and they basically were making...
It's a matter of how to... And it's interesting, even that first generation interpreted their own document differently, and certainly the next few generations had extremely different ways of looking at the Constitution and the founding, and we certainly see that in the early 19th century, especially over the issues of the extension and expansion of slavery, tariffs, things of that nature, states, I suppose, federal authority.
Before we get off this this summer program, I just want to kind of lay out dates and those kinds of things so you'll have an idea of what we got planned. Because we'll have a whole new group of teachers coming in. As I mentioned, we have almost 50. I think we sent out 47 letters of acceptance so far that we're really excited about a couple of things, which we'll share with you on Saturday. I wanted to lay out the dates that will be together in the summer, so you can begin to make your plans now. You all are the veterans. Many of the teachers will be beginning. So for them, we will bring everybody together on the 29th of June, which is a Wednesday, and we're going to bring all the new people together on the 29th of June. And in 4 days, Wednesday and Thursday of the last 2 days of June, and then the following week, beginning on Tuesday after the 4th, July 5th, and Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, excuse me, Tuesday and Wednesday, we're going to do in 4 days what we've done here with the founding. We are going to bring this whole new group of teachers up where you are now. We're going to do what we did this past summer in 2 weeks. We're going to do in 4 days. You all, since you've already had the founding, you all will not have to report until the second Wednesday, which will be July 6th. So we will have our new people on the 29th and 30th of June, and then Tuesday and Wednesday, the 5th and 6th of July. And then you all will come back on Thursday, which will be July 7th. And we will begin the 19th century, and we'll do Thursday and Friday, and the following Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And in that mix will be Phil Roden and the DBQ. And basically what they will be doing will be introducing the ideas of DBQ. And, of course, you all will be veterans of this by that time. But they will be introducing DBQ, and they'll be looking at a unit out of the Mini-Q book from the 19th century from the Civil War. And they'll be doing one of the DBQs that they have there. And for our new people, it will be a new experience. For you, it will be the second time through on the DBQs. And so basically, our program this summer will begin on Wednesday, June 29th, and will end on Thursday, July 14th, hopefully. And what I'm basically saying in the letters to the new people is if we need that last Friday, the 15th, we'll take it. But basically, we're looking at 10 days. And for you, it'll only be basically 6 days. It'll be you won't have to come the first week. So your first day to report will be Thursday, July 7th. And you'll have Thursday and Friday, and then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, the 14th. And if need be, we'll do a program on that last Friday, since we'll have it and we'll have everybody here. But we'll know that as we go. We're kind of guessing that we can finish, hopefully, in the 10 days. So we've got a lot planned, a lot to do. Can't tell you how excited we are to have Dave Bard and to be looking at a field trip and going to Lewisburg and spending the day there, not only together, all of us, but also with Dave Bard, who basically can tell us what we're doing and what happened there. For those of you, I know many of you had Dave in class, and you've probably taken field trips with him. And I mean, the stories still ring around Concord about you haven't lived and you haven't taken a class at Concord unless you've been on a field trip with Dave Bard. So, in essence, that's where we are. Keith, I guess how long did that take?
About an hour.
About an hour. God, we're halfway through and we haven't even started yet. Let's get into some of the material, some of the content, and see what we can accomplish. Again, if you have a question or a comment or you'd like something addressed, just email bobkincaid@gmail.com. That's Bob Kincaid, spell out his name, K-I-N-C-A-I-D, @gmail.com, and we'll make sure that we address your question. But again, we got an email today from one of you, and we're going to address that. Sherry, we're going to address that issue on Friday, on Saturday when we get together. One of the questions that one of our teachers from Monroe County raised was trying to get an idea as to what some of you or others of you are doing in order to expose your students to the kinds of things we're talking about in terms of research skills and all of that. And that's what Saturday is about. So we'll address that issue on Saturday. I want to try to get into a little bit of content here and focus mainly on the questions that I've asked you. And I want to do this, and I mean this very, very sincerely, with the syllabus that we sent you, the syllabus that is available on Blackboard.
which is like the first chapter of a master's thesis in terms of its length.
It certainly is. It certainly is. I had no idea what I was going to do when I did it, when I started to do it. But two things are happening here. One is that I'm rediscovering my love for this material in this period. The more I read, and some of the stuff like Merrill Jensen's book, and we'll get into that in a second, but Merrill Jensen's book, I haven't read Merrill Jensen's book since 1965, 66. I went to the University of Wisconsin and entered Jensen's seminar in the fall, in September of 1965. Graduated from college in 65 and went to Madison for my master's degree in that fall. And that's when I met Merrill Jensen, and I ended up in his seminar. And, of course, the first thing that everybody had to do was read Jensen's books. And so I read the Articles of Confederation, and great book, I thought. I had no idea what I was reading. It's the first thing I read on the Confederation. And now, because of this experience, I actually reread carefully Jensen's Articles of Confederation. First of all, I can't believe how good it is. As I get older, it's like the old story when we're growing up and we're teenagers, we kind of feel that our parents are stupid and they don't know anything about what they're telling us. They don't know anything. And then as we start to get older, we begin to appreciate how intelligent our parents were. I'm getting a renewed appreciation for Merrill Jensen. This is one of the fun. I'm just honored to have been selected by him to be in the seminar and to have known him and worked with him. That's why I have the strong feeling for John Kaminsky that I do. John is the next best thing to Merrill Jensen as far as I'm concerned, because John is on top of all of these sources and he's writing books like crazy and he's publishing this stuff and he's leaving all of this knowledge, all this. If there's one thing that I was disappointed about with Merrill Jensen, it's the fact that he died with all of this knowledge. And he didn't leave it for the rest of us like John Kaminsky is. John's written, I believe, 17 books, something like that, 17 or 18 books on this period. And everything that John knows, everything that John has learned, he's sharing with us in his books. And I admire that incredibly. And I know you all appreciated John as well. And so anyway, that's one of the things that I'm just, so I'm having a renewal as it were in my own appreciation for the period, my own love of the period and that kind of thing. But what I want you to know is this is a 3-credit course, and I'm asking you to write essays, and I'm grading those essays. Now I've got some from Unit 1 and I'm still waiting for others, and I'll take them. I want you to write these essays and address these questions and think about it. We'll get to this in a second, because I want to deal with this article that's on Blackboard called Solitude and Leadership. I want to think of it. I want to spend a little bit of time with that tonight. But I want you to reflect on these questions. But please don't get the idea, because it looks like I'm overwhelming you with reading material, that I'm expecting you to prepare for traditional tests on this stuff. What I'm trying to do is make you aware of what I know, within reason. And I'm trying to say, as I read and I try to get my arms around this period, I mean, the purpose of this grant is to give you, the classroom teacher, information that you need on where to go and what to look for in order to really teach this period and to enhance your understanding of the content. And it's not a question of traditional, I test you, I give you fill-in questions and all this stuff. That pretest that we took, the one that you'll be taking this Saturday on the Civil War, the pretest is because the federal government wants hard, demonstrable evidence of what you knew when we began and what you knew at the end. And so they want some. We've got to prepare that. Dorothy Williams is going to talk a little bit about that on Saturday, because that's what she's here for. Is she wants to make sure that we can measure how successful we were, not us, you, how successful you were in terms of your teaching. So one of the things that she's going to address on Saturday is how we can find ways to document the issues that are affecting your class and the things that are happening in your classrooms. And that's what we want to address. That's why the DBQs.
You know, Bill, whenever I teach history, I try to make the point that history is not what happened. History is something you do. It's a process by which you reconstruct the past by looking at evidence and bringing that evidence together and getting the meaning out of that evidence. And so what I've found, though, is when students do that, and I believe this is probably true on any level, it's certainly true on the college level, when students do that, they get content.
Yeah.
If they do that, they get content in the process of doing it.
Your standards, the standards that you are measured by as teachers, are measured by your students' understanding of content. In other words, what you are addressing in the standards is content. We believe that the way we're approaching this period, the content's going to take care of itself. As you reflect on and think about the questions that we're raising or trying to raise, what we want you to do is spend more. We don't want you to spend time taking tests and writing papers. We want you to spend time thinking and reading and reflecting, not just reading for tests, but reading with the idea of taking the time to reflect on what it is you're reading about and why it's important and what your students can learn from it and need to know about it. That's really what this is about. So what I'm trying to do, and I'm trying to justify myself because of the length of that syllabus. I am not trying to overwhelm you with reading. What I'm trying to do is lay out in this syllabus where I think the information you need to do what you want to do can be found. I'm trying to point out where the sources are, how to access them, the kinds of questions to raise, and I'm leaving it up to you as the expert in the classroom. You are the teacher. You figure out how to make this content meaningful to your students, and if you do it, the payback will be immense. Because I think that's why I wanted you to read the article on solitude and leadership. Because I think the payoff that we're looking for is reflected in that article, and we'll touch on that a little bit in a second. But that's what I want you to do. I'm not expecting you to read and master all the information in Gordon Wood's book and all the information in Pauline Myers' book. What I'm saying is, if you want to teach ratification of the United States Constitution, and you want to make students aware of what the major issues were in ratification, pick a state, pick a chapter out of Pauline Myers' book. Go to Massachusetts and look at the way Massachusetts fought out ratification of the Constitution. Or look at Virginia. Look at the debates. Look at Patrick Henry. I think I raised this issue on the syllabus. All we hear about as history teachers, all we hear about is Patrick Henry's giving me liberty, giving me death speech at St. John's Church in Richmond. If you read the speeches and look at the arguments that Patrick Henry made in order to try to defeat the Constitution of the United States, if you don't end up with a greater appreciation of Patrick Henry than you ever had before, I don't know where it is. I'm not defending Patrick Henry. He could have been a scumbag. I don't know. All I know is that Patrick Henry was absolutely driven with the idea that this Constitution of the United States was the worst thing that could happen to Americans, to Virginians. And he did everything that he could do to defeat it. And to me, the greatest compliment you can get is from your enemies, from your competitors. James Madison said that Patrick Henry was so powerful and such a tremendous speaker that there was no way in the world that you could get anything of substance through Virginia without taking into consideration the need to get it by Patrick Henry. If you could win Patrick Henry over to your side, you had it made. The greatest compliment that anybody could pay Patrick Henry was the compliment that he received from James Madison, who was absolutely opposed to everything that Patrick Henry supported, and he basically was on the opposite side of Patrick Henry in almost everything. But Patrick Henry was so powerful and so effective and so influential with the people of Virginia, that in order to get anything meaningful through, you had to deal with the reality of Patrick Henry.
But then when you look at most American history textbooks, Patrick Henry just drops out.
Patrick Henry disappears. Everybody
drops out of the narrative. Out of the narrative.
Well, everybody knows, most people know that he did become governor of Virginia.
Right.
But Big deal. You know, as Glenn Beck says, when somebody points out that his command of the facts was a little bit iffy, Glenn Beck says, it doesn't matter. The major point still stands. You know, what I say goes. And people believe that Patrick Henry passed out of existence. And Sam Adams, I mean, look at the role that Sam Adams played in getting the Constitution through in Massachusetts. Look at the role that John Hancock played. John Hancock was the most influential person, not only in Massachusetts, but one of the most influential people in all of North America at the time. And everybody knows about Sam Adams in bringing about independence. But the role that Sam Adams played and the role that John Hancock played in the debate over the Constitution of Massachusetts is unbelievable. Because in Massachusetts, they knew, John Adams and the rest of them, Fisher Ames and the rest of them knew, that if you could get Hancock on your side, you had the Constitution. And they barely made it in Massachusetts. And the way they did it is they suggested to Hancock that he could be vice president of the United States under the Constitution. And if George Washington played out the role that George Washington always plays, which is the role of humility, the argument was, push comes to shove, George Washington might not even be willing to be president. And if that's the case, who but you, John? And basically, they won over John Hancock's support for the Constitution in Massachusetts by practically promising him that he would be eventually president of the United States. It was a con job. And they played to his vanity to do it. What a story for kids about vanity. And the stories of Patrick Henry. I mean, look at the debates. If you have access to the Adams, the John Adams video series that was on public broadcasting, look at the time when John Adams is nominating, when they're selecting a commander of the Continental Army.
Yes.
And they talk about, and John Hancock thinks it's going to be him. And John Adams talk about there's a man among us who is more qualified and more able and has the background and has the expertise. And the reports are that John Hancock is puffing up with pride and all this. And then he said, George Washington. and basically recommended the appointment of George Washington as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. Of course, it passes Congress. It was a brilliant political move on the part of the Adamses to make Washington commander. Everybody believed that Massachusetts was driving the move for independence. What better way to make it a united movement than to appoint a Virginian as the commander of the Continental Army? But Hancock's vanity was incredible. Everybody knew it. But the fact of the matter is, read in this book about Hancock and what Hancock did to build the political following that he had. Literally, Hancock in the 18th century was the equivalent of the person today who brings turkeys around to poor families on Thanksgiving, that brings pre-cooked Thanksgiving dinners to poor families who can't afford them. Hancock was the classic example of the modern political boss who basically, if you saw the movie The Godfather or you read Puzo's book on The Godfather, you talk about the fact that the Godfather would do favors for you, and at some point in time, if he wanted a payback, he came to you and you were expected to deliver. Hancock did this. He built this political following, this tremendous political following. Hancock was the person who had money but could relate to the poor people, and he realized that he would need their support in order to basically be politically successful, and he did that. He did it so well. Brilliant stuff. So that's kind of what we're talking about. So in the syllabus, to go back and make a long story longer, I guess. basically, what I'm suggesting is that please don't be overwhelmed. Again, I'm trying to basically give you create a context and say these are the parameters within which what you're teaching happened. These are the places to get the best information. These are the places to gain access to the primary sources. And basically, as teachers, I trust to your expertise as a professional in the classroom to go where you need to go and do what you need to do in order to fulfill your responsibilities as a professional educator. Basically, what I'm trying to do in this humongous 19-page syllabus, which is just one unit of the course, by the way, what I'm trying to do is fulfill my own professional responsibilities to myself in terms of what I committed to do on this grant and what I hope I can do to help you. So this syllabus, I felt it necessary to try to share with you what I think people are doing. What I tried to do is walk very, very briefly. This is just an overview. But go through the period and the treatment of the Constitution, the treatment of the founders, especially as it's being played out today in the competition between liberals and conservatives for our political ear in 21st century America. And basically, I tried to share with you what I think are the positive aspects of a very strong conservative effort to claim the founders. And I went back to Leo Strauss, because Leo Strauss, University of Chicago, is kind of the guru of this, and talked in the syllabus about the establishment of the National Review and the origins of a really viable conservative movement in America, and what it suggests about the founders and what they're trying to do with the founders and why. And the whole point of this is not to memorize it for the purposes of an exam, obviously. What I'm trying to do is say, this is the context. This is what's going on today with what we're teaching, you and me and Keith and everybody. This is what we're given the responsibility to do with students. And in order to do an adequate job, and in order to do justice to the ethics of the profession, we've got to basically equip our students so they can get their hands on what they need to have in order to make intelligent, informed decisions rather than be susceptible and vulnerable to whatever people tell them, whether they turn on MSNBC and listen to Rachel Maddow or whether they turn on Fox and listen to Glenn Beck. I'm serious. The point is that the one thing that those two things have in common, what one thing we're trying to do, is avoid the tendency to fall into the trap of being vulnerable to what one person tells us the truth is or what some other person tells us the truth is. We're trying to, this is what real education is equipping our students to be able to pursue truth for themselves. And that's what we're about. That's what I tried to do with this syllabus. That's why it's so long. I don't want you to be overly intimidated. If you look at the questions, the study questions at the end, the essay questions that I hope you'll answer, you'll notice that there's some choice in there. And what I'm saying is go where your needs as a teacher take you. I try to provide as best I can what I think you will need in order to make informed decisions about the best place to go in order to get the content you need. And so with that, let me
start. That's basically, you would argue, the importance of the historiographical section.
Yes.
Of this. I mean, you start with Fisk and Beard and
right.
Show how they've been reacted to at various
right.
times and how they've influenced various schools of thought, I guess you might say. And this is true of any area in American history or any area in history anywhere.
This
yeah.
is the one I know.
Yeah, I mean, we could do this with Civil War. Even
well, yeah, you could do it with
you
could do it with American foreign policy.
Certainly,
you could do it
yeah.
with constitutional history. I mean, you know, if you think about the interpretations of the Constitution today, and you look at originalism and the views of Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court, and this summer, you'll be exposed to Stanley Cutler is one of the gurus of the idea of a living Constitution, which is anathema to Antonin Scalia. Scalia believes that the only way to interpret the Constitution of the United States is to go back and understand the way the founders believed what the founders believed when they wrote it, when they approved it. And of course, Cutler believes that the strength of the American Constitution, the strength of American democracy, is its ability to adjust to changing times. That's what's allowed it. That's what has allowed it to survive to this point. And according to Cutler, that's what's going to allow it to survive for an indefinite number of years into the future. So, again, what we're trying to do is cover what we think are the real issues. And you're right. Every issue has its own historical debate as to what the proper way is to present that particular material. This is the stuff that I kind of know. And believe me, I appreciate this opportunity because it's been 25 years since I've been into this stuff. And so for me, it's been kind of a rebirth, in academic and intellectual rebirth. Unfortunately, I've spent most of my weekends reading, going back into the 18th century with John Kaminsky, rather than spending time with my wife. But that's another issue. That's what I'm trying to do with the syllabus. Please look at it in that context. I'm not trying to overwhelm or scare anybody or drive anybody away or create an impossible obstacle to you or anything like that. Basically, what I'm trying to do is fulfill my professional responsibilities, which is to provide for you as teachers the best opportunity to get a handle on where to go for some of this information, the best that I can do.
I think this is strong, and usually when I try to teach something, very often I'll start with an historiographical approach. I mean, here are the different schools of thought. I rewrote a piece on Napoleon here recently, and I look at the two or three different, major schools about how he's interpreted. And so when you start that way, then you present the evidence. The idea is what I want is for students to kind of see where the evidence leads them, not necessarily for them to think, oh, I want to go with this school of thought, but to see where the evidence brings them. And so I think that background, that context in terms of the historiography, is a good jump-off place. And with many of these works, especially things like Beard and even Fisk, these things are available for free online.
Yeah, online. And
because, no one's making any money off of these books anymore. So
John Fisk's book is available online on Google. If you just Google, just go to google.com, and in Google just write John Fisk's Critical Period, and you'll get the book on Google Books, and the whole book is available online. Jensen's Articles of Confederation the same way. It's a couple of pages left out here and there because they don't want to give you the whole thing. But basically, all you need is there. I would say 95% of Jensen's book is available on the Articles of Confederation. No need to buy them at all. But, one of the things I wanted to say very honestly, and I said this in this historiographical treatment, I went to graduate school with Merrill. I studied under Merrill Jensen. So I am. I'm not trying to say that I am one of Jensen's products.
Right.
And so the way I look at this period is in many, many ways attributable to Merrill Jensen and my training under Merrill Jensen. I admit that. And I'm not saying that that's the only way to look at it. One of the things that I tried to do in the syllabus is point out that the University of Wisconsin, during the progressive period in the early 20th century, beginning with Frederick Jackson Turner, and then looking at Carl Becker, and looking at Curtis Nettles, and looking at Merrill Jensen, and this whole string of historians, one who trained the next one, that ultimately all of them came out of the same school. Charles Beard was a student of Becker's. And that ultimately what you find is that the people who came through this school tended to look at the period the same way, and they what are referred to as progressive historians, and they're the ones that pick up on this way of reading history. And Jensen was one, and I was there. So was John Kaminsky. And many of the people that I've listed here who are writing the history of the Constitution and the Confederation period today, Ron Hoffman and Ken Bowling, and some of the people that we've had here on these grants, these are people that I know. And we all went to school together, and we all studied with Merrill Jensen, and his aura just overwhelms all of us. But that's not the only way. And what I was trying to suggest is today at Princeton University, and I belong to this group, I've gone to four of their five sessions so far at the James Madison Center at Princeton University. And in fact, one of our presenters this summer, Carson Holloway, very, very active in the James Madison Center. He was a James Madison Fellow. And what this means is this has become the hub. This has become the place which is churning out the intellectual part of modern conservatism in America, just as the Wisconsin School was putting out historians of the progressive era 75 and 100 years ago. So basically, the way that conservatives today are looking at the sources and looking at this period, These folks are coming out predominantly out of the James Madison Center for Study of American Ideals at Princeton University. And I've gone to the sessions, and I know some of these people. And I'm not saying that they're all crazy. I don't agree with them, but they are not crazy. They're very, very intelligent, bright people who have an agenda. But I would suggest to you that the Merrill Jensens and those folks had an agenda as well. And so what I'm trying to say is we need to make sure that our students understand that people have an agenda. They're trying to persuade them of a particular way to look at history. And what we want to do is try to get them to say, go back to the sources and let the sources tell you what the truth is, not what somebody is trying to argue. And I think that's where the DBQ and where Phil Roden comes in. He's trying to show us how to put together a historical argument to defend our own point of view. And that's an important piece of this whole puzzle.
The difference between studying history and doing history.
Doing history.
History is something you do. It's an action. So
history is written. There's no other way around it. Because what you find, and I find this as I found this as I wrote this, that you don't know going in what you're going to say. You begin to say something, and then you reflect. And as you reflect, the next thing begins to come into play. And basically, it writes itself. If you spend your time in solitude and reflecting on the sources will tell you where to go and what to say. That's the pursuit of truth. And that's what we want to get our students to appreciate and understand and respect. Is a respect for learning, a respect for scholarship. That's what we want to have as teachers. That's what we want to have as historians. That's what we want our students to have as citizens in this country.
Because sometimes the sources will take you somewhere that you don't want to go.
Right.
And you will arrive at conclusions that you didn't initially have. In fact, almost certainly it's going to do that. I mean, you might start with certain assumptions, but as you get into the sources, if you're honest about your approach to the sources, it may take you somewhere where you don't want to go.
You know, it's not fair to take what you just said and use it as a lead-in.
Uh-oh.
But I was in Merrill Jensen's seminar. Now, I've got to ask you, can you imagine what I believed when I first read John Fiske's book after having been in Merrill Jensen's seminar? To Merrill Jensen, John Fiske was out of his mind. I mean, it was so slanted and so one-sided and so artificial. And Jensen used to mock John Fiske, who wrote the first real story of the Confederation period. And that book is available online called The Critical Period in American History, 1781 to 1789, I think is the exact title. It's available on Google. Just Google John Fiske and you'll get it. Well, it's kind of like Uncle Tom's Cabin. You know, nobody reads Uncle Tom's Cabin because everybody tells you what it's about. So there's no need to read it. Well, for me, there was no reason to read John Fiske because Merrill Jensen told me that John Fiske didn't know which end was up, that John Fiske had a story that he wanted to tell, and he manipulated the sources in order to support the story that he wanted to tell. That was Merrill Jensen's story. So I put that down in my mind. I filed that away. And basically what I filed is John Fiske's interpretation that basically the truth is the exact opposite of what John Fiske said. That's what I got out of Merrill Jensen's approach to John Fiske. So now, with its being available online, I this past several weeks in preparation as part of this, I went to Google and I read John Fiske's Critical Period of American History. And it's fine. It's a great job. Now, the interpretation is there, and there's no question that John Fiske was out to prove something about the founders and about the Constitution. John Fiske basically believed that American independence and everything that went with it was a tremendous opportunity for the former colonies of Great Britain, but it could be lost in what he called the most critical years, 1783, when the peace treaty was signed, until 1789, when the Constitution went into effect. John Fiske's argument was that if it hadn't been for the Constitution of the United States, the American Revolution and all that went with it would have been lost. Because the period of independence under the Articles of Confederation was so critical, was so negative, there were so many things wrong with the structure of government in the 1780s, that if it hadn't been for the founders of the writers of the Constitution, the Madisons and the Hamiltons, and if you read John Fiske's book, I've never seen a more positive treatment of Alexander Hamilton. Fisk believed that Alexander Hamilton was the only one that really had it all together. He didn't question at all the need for a stronger government. The stronger, the better. Hamilton's belief was that the Constitution we ended up with was as strong a government as they could get away with. And more power to them, was Hamilton's belief. And Fisk's belief. Fisk believed that the nature of the country in the 1780s was so desperate that if the Constitution hadn't been ratified, the whole experiment in popular government would have gone down the tubes. Basically, then he went back and wrote the history of the Confederation period, of the period when we lived under the Articles of Confederation. Fisk wrote the history of the period and read the sources with his conclusion already in mind. He knew that the Constitution had saved the day, and he was going back to collect evidence to prove it. So therefore, he looked at everything that happened in the research that he was doing with a very, very prescribed view as to how things were. This was desperate. We couldn't conduct foreign policy. We couldn't deal with the Indians. The government didn't have an income. The government didn't have the power to raise money. The government couldn't pay its debts. A government that doesn't pay its debts gets no respect from other nations. A government that has no respect can't conduct effective foreign policy. We couldn't control the Indians in the West. We didn't have a standing army. The government didn't have the power to raise an army. All it could do was ask the states for troops. And so basically, we didn't have the ability to defend ourselves from the Indians or from the French in the Northwest, or the Spanish in the Southwest. We didn't have what we needed to make the nation successful. We weren't paying our debts. We weren't living up to our obligations. We weren't conducting effective foreign policy. We weren't earning respect of other nations, which nations need in order to be successful in this world. In other words, everything that Fisk saw happening in America during the 1780s was negative. And the reality was that if something wasn't done to change it, then America, as we know it, was going to go down the tubes.
Which is kind of a European great power method of viewing the entire American Revolution and subsequent aftermath. The idea that, you know, from the European point of view, especially from the British point of view, that the republic has to fail, that any kind of representative government over large geographic space cannot be successful. That history, up to that point, had taught them that republics were generally, democracies and republics were small political entities, small geographic entities. So he's really kind of almost viewing things from a European viewpoint, which makes sense in terms of how he views the conclusion of the peace treaty in 1783, and the whole issue of independence and how really the United States is not seen by him as a major player, but essentially a pawn in the game. And Britain's trying to, of course, secure her interests, and France is trying to secure their interests. And it just happened to us that we came along at a time in which, you know, Britain thought, well, giving independence will be useful for their interests. And so that kind of approach really almost sees it from the perspective of Europe, kind of a more traditional diplomatic history viewpoint.
If you read on the Internet, read John Fisk's first chapter on the diplomacy of the American Revolution. The only thing that I'd ever read when I was in graduate school, I read a book by Samuel Flagg Bemis. It was written in the 50s called The Diplomacy of the American Revolution. And it looked at the efforts of Franklin in Europe, in France, and John Adams in England, and John Jay in England, to negotiate a peace treaty to end the revolution and win our independence. But they looked at it from the perspective of the American diplomats.
Right.
John Fisk looks at foreign policy during the time of the American Revolution from the perspective of France and England and Spain. And he begins to look, and basically in his first chapter, he treats American, in other words, the thing that amazed me, I've been at this a long time, and I'm still amazed by this stuff. But when I read Fisk, I told Keith, I walked down the hallway, and I told Keith, and I said, Keith, this is fabulous. This is the greatest chess game I've ever read in my life. What it tells you, is if you read John Fisk, it tells you that American independence was so far down the list of priorities for France or Spain or anybody else. Every nation was conducting foreign policy at that time for its own benefit. None of them cared about American independence but the Americans. And so France was trying to play off the colonies against England and England against the colonies. England's trying to play off the colonies in order to split the alliance we have with France. So England's major goal is to split up the alliance we form with France, while France's major goal is to contain Great Britain. American independence becomes a chess piece, and they just keep moving it around. So when you think about this illusion that we won our independence, England gave us our independence because it suited her to do it. Otherwise, the war would have gone on and on and on. It just wasn't worth it. But I was telling Keith when I walked down after reading first chapter, I said, God, Keith, this is amazing. This is the best mystery that I've seen in a long time. This is a Jessica Fletcher kind of thing, where everybody's playing everybody else off, and finally, the person that sees through it is John Jay. John Jay goes over there and realizes that England and France are having secret negotiations about the world after the revolution's over. And here we are, allied with France, fighting a war with Britain for our independence. And naturally, we would assume that they're enemies and they're not talking. They're regularly talking. And we, the colonies, are pawns in their conversation. And so France's point of view is to make sure that England and her colonies don't get back together again. England's point of view is to make sure that France and the colonies don't stay allied, don't stay united. So their goal is to split up that alliance. And independence is the way to do it. If they give us our independence, our primary gratitude is going to be to Great Britain, not to France. So ultimately, what happens in the Jefferson administration and the struggles between France and England, while John Adams is president.
Even in the Washington administration with Hamilton.
Yeah. The issue of whether you support France during the Revolution or whether you support, whether you're opposed to the French Revolution or not. All this is played out at the time of independence. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating. It's a fascinating chess game. How do you basically say this is the story? That this is the interpretation of the American Revolution. You can't say that. So basically, Fisk's book is incredible. It's just incredible. It's well worth reading. And it's free on the Internet. Then you've got my guy, Merrill Jensen, in the Articles of Confederation. It's not a huge book, but it is absolutely an incredible book. And let me, if I can share with you, Keith, how are we doing on time, bud? Okay, we got about 15 to 20 minutes.
20 minutes.
Okay. I wanted to share a couple of quotes with you, just to give you a flavor. At the opening of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787, May, Edmund Randolph, the governor of Virginia, gives the opening address welcoming the delegates from the various states to the convention in Philadelphia. And this is a portion of Edmund Randolph's address to the convention delegates at the opening of the Constitutional Convention in 1787. He basically says that the framers of the Confederation, of the Articles of Confederation, were wise and were great men, but he says, quote, human rights were the chief knowledge of the time. Since then, he said, now I'm quoting, our chief danger arises from the democratic parts of our constitutions. Edmund Randolph is saying to the delegates in Philadelphia, everything was pretty good during the Confederation, but the reason we're here is because the greatest danger to our nation arises from the democratic parts of our constitutions, our state constitutions. So basically, what Randolph is saying, I don't know how else to say it, what Randolph is saying is the reason we're here is because there's too much democracy in this country, and we're going to lose what we won with independence if we don't do something about it. Randolph goes on. It is a maxim which I hold incontrovertible, that the powers of government exercised by the people swallows up the other branches. None of the constitutions have provided sufficient checks against the democracy. The feeble Senate of Virginia is a phantom, Maryland has a more powerful Senate, but the late distractions in that state have discovered that is not powerful enough. The check established in the Constitution of New York and Massachusetts is yet a stronger barrier against democracy, but they all seem insufficient. In other words, going through state after state after state, Randolph is saying to the delegates at the beginning of the Constitution Convention, guys, there's too much damn democracy in this country, and if we do something about it, we're going down the tubes. Then they take a vote to scrap the articles and write a whole new constitution, and they also take a vote to hold their debates in secret so that the people, they all commit themselves to silence outside the walls of the convention so that the people out there won't know what we're up to until after we do it. And this passes. Jensen goes on. Alexander Hamilton was in profound agreement with Randolph, says Jensen, and his views are equally illuminating of the character and purpose of the Federalist Party. This is a quote from Madison's notes at the Constitutional Convention. All communities, Hamilton said in the convention, all communities divide themselves into the few and the many. The first, the few, are the rich and the well-born. The other, the mass of the people. If the rich and the well-born are given a permanent share in government, they will ever after oppose any change in its form. And then Jensen goes on to say, he had only contempt for the popular belief that the voice of the people was the voice of God. The people, he said, seldom judge rightly. In the Federalist Papers, he took the position that government had been instituted to provide constraint because the passions of men will not conform to the dictates of reason and justice. John Jay, at the Constitutional Convention, did not elaborate his beliefs, says Jensen, to the same extent as did his fellow Federalists, but John Jay contented himself with his favorite maxim, quote, the people who own this country ought to govern it, unquote. If you look at those quotes on pages 3 and 4 of Jensen's book, you begin to see where he's going. Jensen argues that the architects, the framers of the U.S. Constitution, were not driven by the desperate circumstances of the Confederation into writing the Constitution. In other words, they challenged Fisk. Jensen's argument is that the founders came there to undo the extreme democracy that was unleashed under the Articles of Confederation. The only way that you could control the democratic tendencies that were happening during the Confederation period was to create a national government that was stronger than the state governments. You had to limit the power of the states and put power on the national level in order to get power out of the hands of the majority of the people. And so Jensen's point of view, Jensen's argument about the Articles of Confederation and the origins of the Constitution, Jensen believes that the Constitution of the United States was in fact a counter-revolution in order to undo the democracy that was unleashed with independence and to undo the philosophy of the Declaration of Independence which justified that democracy.
Which gets you into a fundamental in interpretive conflict that's even present today, the idea whether or not the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution are different.
Right.
Whether they're in conflict or whether they're symbiotic is one of the arguments that's going around now. The idea that what kind of continuity or lack of continuity exists between the two documents.
Right. And in this book, which is fairly recent, Woody Holton is a historian, constitutional historian at the University of Richmond, and he's written this book called Unruly Americans. This one will be available to us later. It's not available on Kindle, and I had to order it in hardback. It's on sale. I got it for 10-something. And Keith Butcher has ordered copies for everybody, and this will be available to everybody in hard copy. I'm guessing that it'll be available on ebook on Kindles eventually. But at this point, I've ordered everybody a hard copy. But the point, what Woody Holton, His basic argument is that the founders those who drafted the Constitution of the United States and wrote the Federalist Papers were committed to the idea that you had to take power out of the hands of the states because the states were too easily controlled by the majority of the people. That, in other words, if you think about it, if the states were supreme, as they were under the Articles were weak, if the states were supreme and the majority of the people got control of the state government, then there was no national government over them. And what I tried to suggest in their syllabus is that those conservative folks like Joseph Galloway and John Dickinson and James Wilson of Pennsylvania and some of the other conservatives, the reason that they were afraid of independence, because they knew that it was the power of Great Britain, the power of the mother country, that kept the lid on the society that Gordon Wood talks about in his Radicalism of the American Revolution. That you had all of these democratic tendencies ready to explode in America if you didn't have the mother country to keep the lid on. And the fear of independence for them was that once you took away that power and unleashed the democracy that was bubbling up in America, there was nothing to control it. And so the founders' argument at Philadelphia in 1787 was that the democracy that was unleashed by independence had to be recontained and put back in the box. And the Constitution of the United States was the lid of that box. So you can see how different Jensen's approach to the Confederation period is from John Fisk's. In other words, one of the best conversations I had this summer with John Kaminsky was we were having a refreshment break when John Kaminsky was with us this summer. We were standing out at the table there, and John was getting a drink. And John made the point to me, and he said, "You know, Bill, the more I read about this, the more of these guys I read, the more I'm convinced that the Confederation period could have worked." His argument
was... Which is not at all what's in anyone's textbook,
no,
right?
John believed that the Confederation period had the potential to work. The reason it didn't work is because there were too many people who had a political agenda and had reasons why it shouldn't work. Because the fact of the matter is, if the majority of the people have power... I mean, if you think about this, somebody has power. Somebody makes decisions everywhere, in the family, in the household, at work. Somebody makes the call. Somebody makes the decision. And the reality is, if the majority of the people aren't making the decision, then a minority of the people make decision. If the many aren't calling the shots, then the few are calling the shots. And John Kaminsky believes, and I tend to agree with him, that part of the story behind the Constitution is to get government out of the potential hands of the majority of the people. And by doing that, you're putting it into the hands of the minority. Woody Holton argues in his Unruly Americans, Woody Holton argues in his epilogue at the end of the book that the irony of the whole situation is that the founders, the writers of the Constitution, painted a picture that the Confederation period was the period in which the rural people, the small people, had power, and they blew it. In other words, Holton's argument is the unfairest part of this whole story is that the Federalists in 1787 at the Constitutional Convention, the Federalists argued that the people had their chance and they couldn't handle power. They failed. And Holton argues that that's one of the unfairest aspects of the whole story, is to argue that the people had power when, in fact, they never really did, because power was wielded on the state level by elites there. But the implication of the founders of the Federalists was that the people had power, and they demonstrated during the Confederation period that they could not govern themselves, and they needed the elite to come back and take control in order to lead them in the right direction. That's Woody Holton says that's one of the most unfair charges that this period gives us. But can you believe how absolutely exciting? This is just a fantastic story. Now the question is, how do you teach it? What do you do with this? Do you skip it? You know, one of the things that we had during our summer, the last day when we did our team reports this summer, one of the things that amazed me, and I said this in my evaluation that I sent out afterwards, is the number of people, of us, the number of people that began their presentations by saying, this is the way I teach this. This is the way I usually teach this. What we're about here is we're trying to suggest that there are other ways of teaching this. And the way to do it is to throw the responsibility to your students. Have them read the sources. Have them divide them into teams. Have them do the research. Have them answer the questions. And have them come back and argue with each other about their position on major issues. That's what the DBQ thing is all about, is to try to get students involved in their own education, which means taking it out of our hands and putting it in theirs.
So that we evaluate not the interpretation, but how the interpretation was arrived at.
The irony is, remember in math, I used to do this because I never could do it anyway, but in math, remember they used to say, I give credit for your work. Don't just give me the answers to the problems, but I want to see your work, and I'll give you partial credit even if you got the wrong answer. And what they're basically saying is the answer doesn't matter. It's the process. Well, what you're saying right now is the same thing. That I'm not going to stand here and say absolutely that John Fisk is wrong and Merrill Jensen's right. I'm not going to stand here and say that John Fisk is right and Merrill Jensen is wrong. What I'm going to say is I want to look at the sources. I want to try to figure out what seems to make sense to me and do the best job I can to argue from my point of view as to what the truth seems to be to me as an honest, intelligent, reflective person who has a brain and is willing to use it. And that, I would suggest to you, is what education is. And this document, this article on solitude and leadership, which talks about the fact that the real leaders are the people who can concentrate and reflect. What I liked most about this article was what he does with the people who claim that they can multitask. And he points to the experiment, to the study that they did at Stanford, which proves, A, that people can't really multitask, and the people who claim that they can do a worse job at it than the people who claim that they can't do it. That real education is based, he calls it solitude, is based on the ability to reflect, the ability to consider, the ability to think about options and alternatives, and the alone time that we need to really think about options. That's where real leadership and vision comes from. Everybody else, he points out, merely follows. And he says there are two approaches to leadership. One is the person who can really reflect and come up with real alternatives, and he uses David Petraeus as an example of this. Of course, he's speaking to the plebes at West Point, and he uses David Petraeus as an example of that kind of leadership. But then he talks about the other ones who merely get out and head ahead of the group and lead it off the cliff. In other words, everybody is headed for the cliff, and these people, the products of bureaucracy, just get out in front and lead them there. They don't really take them anywhere different. They just basically make sure that what is supposed to happen happens.
I'll give you a quote from him here. He says, "We have a crisis of leadership in America because our overwhelming power and wealth earned under earlier generations of leaders made us complacent. And for too long, we have been training leaders who only know how to keep the routine going."
Yeah.
People who know how to, in his words, how to climb the greasy pole.
Yeah, exactly.
And he sees that in government. He sees that in institutions of higher learning. He sees that, all around us.
Keith, I swear.
What we're not doing is thinking.
I swear to God, the thing that drives me about this, the reason that I wrote this grant was this article. I didn't write this article, obviously. I wish I did. But when I was writing this grant proposal, and the last year was on leadership, in my mind, I had a view of leadership that is explained in that article. That's why I think I'm so captivated with that article. Because I really believe that people who reflect and think for themselves, that think out of the box, and constantly think of different ways and new ways of doing things, and, you know, is the way we're doing this the right way, and those kinds of things, that those are the people we need to show us alternatives and show us the options that we're not getting to see from people who are trained as opposed to people who are educated. You know, my position always used to be you train animals, you educate people. And unfortunately, much of our education has become training, and we're just teaching people from the behavior of people who went before. And nothing can happen differently if everybody comes out of the same mold. And what he's talking about is a view of leadership that's based on something different, the ability to reflect and the ability to concentrate. And that's really what this is about with the primary sources and stuff. I mean, that's what we're asking. That's what we're talking about here, is a totally different way. And I, without getting on a soapbox here or sermonizing or anything else, it's obvious in this country we've got to begin to do something different than we're doing. And I mean, we're turning out people with 4.0s and degrees up the wazoo.
Well,
we're going down the tubes.
He refers to a generation of technocrats.
Yeah.
We're technocrats. And, you know, it kind of makes me think a little bit in terms of, you remember Joseph Ellis's book that came out a few years ago, Founding Brothers, and he made that point that the founding generation, I mean, where could you find such a group of leaders? Considering the population, the size of the population of America at the time, where could you find another generation of people like Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Hamilton, Franklin, etc.? They were so unique. And if you contrast them to like English leadership, in which everyone has their position by birth, they're part of that system, you know, we certainly had a great advantage in terms of leadership.
It's amazing to me. The greatest disservice that we can pay the founders is to try to impose a modern political agenda
on
them and say, Hamilton was right and all the rest of them were wrong. Don't pay any attention to what the rest of them were saying. It's the Hamilton approach to the strong government and the leadership of the few and all of this that really matters. And then you get the other side that argues just the opposite. And what they're doing is they're discrediting. When you said the founding brothers, and you used the examples of Madison and Hamilton and Patrick Henry and Sam Adams and Hancock. And of course, they were human beings. They all had flaws and they all had faults and all that. And they believed different things. But damn it, they thought.
Yeah.
They had minds and they used them. And they argued their point of view and they believed passionately in the positions that they were arguing. They couldn't all be right because they constantly went at each other.
No, they didn't agree themselves.
But the real respect that we owe them is the respect that comes from reading and seriously taking into consideration what they were trying to say and what they believed. It's not a question of coming down and saying this one was right and that one was wrong, this one was good and that one is bad, this one was an American patriot and this one was a communist. That's not the issue. The issue is that these were intelligent people that tried to think their way through problems, and our education system today has got to begin to turn out the same kinds of people. We have got to, because the road we're on ain't working. It just is not working. So, Keith, I think we're kind of, Bob, are we up near time? We didn't do the questions. I've asked you two at the very end of this document. I've asked you to wrestle with two questions, and then on the third one, I've given you a choice between Beeman's treatment of the convention and Pauline Myers' treatment of ratification. I don't care where you're going to have both books. You know where to get the stuff. You know what's in them. And depending on what you need to teach and what you want to teach, please wrestle with what you pick. Give me your best answer to the question. And basically, in your answer, deal with two things. Deal where you can with primary documents, and deal where you can with how you would teach this stuff, what you think you might be able to do with your students that would make your understanding of this period, this content, not that you know the content, not that you memorized it, but you got a library card, you got the book. Go find it. Bob. Okay. All right. If you go on Google, the two classic books on the Confederation period are John Fiske's book called The Critical Period in American History. And if you go to google.com, just type in John Fiske Critical Period. F-I-S-K-E. And what you'll find is Fiske's book, and one of the entries will be Google Books, and the whole book is available online free. Jensen's book is the same way. On Google, just type in Merrill Jensen, Articles of Confederation. This is the book, Articles of Confederation. S-E-N, and you will find Jensen's book available online on Google Books. The original book, this book, first edition, was 1940. So the book is so old now that they're giving it to us, as Keith pointed out. The two books that we put on Google for the Constitution are Richard Beeman's book called Plain Honest Men. It's 2009 publication. And it's based on Madison's notes on the convention. And Pauline Myers' book called Ratification, which just came out October 2010, Pauline Myers' book is based on John Kaminsky's Ratification Project. And these books we put on the Kindles for Teachers. And if you go to Madison's Notes, which are available free online, Google Madison's Notes and you'll have them. With the calendar, you click in the appropriate day. Basically, you'll have the primary source that gave Beeman the stuff for this book. And if you go to the Rotunda Project that we will have available on Rotunda at Concord's library, you'll have the documents, the Ratification Project documents that gave Pauline Myers the primary sources for her book. So these two books are incredible. So and then of course, Gordon Wood's Pulitzer Prize winner, which is called The Radicalism of the American Revolution, you get everywhere. Every bookstore has it. Walden Books, Dalton Books, Bookland, if it's not out of business already, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. You can get a copy of this book for about $12 hardback. It's well worth it. This is one of the finest books that I've seen on this period.
And the other Gordon Wood that you're going to use is Empire of Liberty. We don't have a copy of that here.
Yeah, it's a book on the size of Pauline Myers' book. It's one of these 650-page jobs. But Gordon Wood's written the best book. It just came out. It's his most recent book. But what we're trying to do is provide our teachers with what they need to go where they feel like they need to go. And again, to our teachers, we'll see you on Saturday. Be safe. Call us if you have any issues or any questions. By all means, feel free to call us. And I'm really looking forward to Saturday and to seeing you. We're going to try to do these chats on a regular basis, because part of the mission of this grant is not only to better inform our teachers about the content of American history for American history teachers, but to make the general public aware, much more aware, of why Senator Byrd, when he created the Teaching American History Grant Program, felt it worthwhile to put millions of federal dollars into the study of American history. We want not only our teachers to avail themselves of this, we want people in our communities to more appreciate the work of the founders and the exploits of the people who made this nation what it is. And that's really what this program's about. So, Bob, I want to thank you for the setup, and I want to thank everybody who joined us this evening, and we'll be back again. We're going to do more of these chats, more and more and more. The Internet is out there. It gives us a tremendous ability to connect and to make each other more aware and to share ideas and points of view, and we plan to do it. So with that, Keith, anything to add, my friend?
I look forward to Saturday. I look forward to hearing what also not just what our presenters are going to say, but also what our teachers are going to say as well.
Okay. Thank you all so very much. It's been a pleasure. I hope that this has been 2 hours that was worth your investment of time. Thank you.
Interpretation, you talk about Mel Jensen, Sid Bell.